Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 66, Napoleon Bonaparte, the Emperor himself. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you'd like to support our podcast, please go to patreon.com/generalsandnapoleon, where you'll find ad-free content and bonus content. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and wherever podcasts are heard. Now, on with the show. We have a very special guest on the line for this episode, one of my favorite authors, the great Andrew Roberts. How are you, Andrew?
On top form. How are you, John?
I'm very well, very well. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Not at all. I'm very impressed with your show. I think it goes into just exactly the right amount of detail. I think you get great guests on. I really enjoy listening.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. When I started the show, I promised myself I would never do a Napoleon-only episode because I thought his marshals and generals and all of his opponents were just as interesting. But guess what we're going to talk about today?
Well, yeah, but we can also talk about his opponents and his marshals. You know, it doesn't have to all be about him.
Sure, sure, true. Yeah, no, I'm just very excited. And for those of you not familiar with Andrew, first of all, he has a great book called Napoleon, A Life, which I've read multiple times. I highly recommend. But Andrew has written a number of books on a number of different subjects, correct?
Yeah, I've written 20 books now. There was one rather misconceived novel, but the other 19 are all history books or biographies.
Very well. And if you want to find Andrew's books, you can go to any independent bookstore. We like to keep those places in business and keep them going strong because they are very important, correct?
Oh, vital. Absolutely vital for writers as well as readers.
Indeed. Indeed. So let's jump in because we know Napoleon's life can be quite detailed. You've published, like we just discussed, a wide range of books on different time periods, on topics such as Churchill, Hitler, King George III, President Roosevelt. Why does Napoleon really stand out to you?
Well, he's such a giant, isn't he? He's somebody who's had as many books written about him, by which I mean his name appears in the title or the subtitle, as there have been days since his death. Mm. Which gives you a sense, both of obviously how nerve-wracking it is to try and write yet another biography of him, but also quite how important he is, quite what a influence he's had on European and world history. And so he is somebody who sort of draws the attention. He's certainly drawn my attention ever since I was about 10 years old, and my dad took me to watch the Great Waterloo film. Mm. I have been fascinated by this man. So when I had the opportunity actually to spend 6 years visiting 53 of his 60 battlefields and writing about him, I jumped at the chance.
All right. Well, I think that's a good explanation. I was a history teacher for a little while and I taught world history, but one day at, like you said, a local bookstore, I picked up a used copy of David Chandler's Campaigns of Napoleon.
Wonderful book.
Oh, my. And I couldn't put it down. I was sitting on a beach and I just read it for 5 hours straight. And I said, oh, my gosh, I got to learn more about this, you know. And from there, it kind of just touched off my interest in the subject. I watched your famous debate with Adam Zamoyski on YouTube, which has over 800,000 views as of this recording, on the idea that Napoleon should be called Napoleon the Great. And it's just fantastic. I contend that he doesn't need the moniker. Some people just need one name, like people in music, like Prince, Madonna, Beethoven, and Mozart. Why is Napoleon such a divisive subject? It seems people either like him or hate him. There's not a lot of in-between on him.
No, that's right. In England, we have the expression Marmite. He's Marmite, which is a food, a bit like Vegemite. I don't know if you have that in America.
I do.
And the advertising people for Marmite have the slogan, you either love it or you hate it. And that's, as you say, it's quite true of Napoleon. I think it's quite clear why people can love Napoleon, and I'm sure we'll go into this. But I think the reason people hate him is for slightly misconceived views. It's because they very often, certainly this is true of British historians, especially British historians who grew up in the shadow of the Second World War, to essentially get Napoleon wrong and to see him as a kind of proto-Hitler figure, which he absolutely was not. And
right.
On so many levels was not. And yet, because he was a dictator, of course, we tend to, and we do it the whole time with history, I'm afraid, we tend to try to see people in the past in the light of things that have happened since their deaths, which is a pretty sort of moronically stupid thing to do, frankly, and we're going to be very angry once we die when people do it to us.
True.
But nonetheless, it's a scourge, especially a scourge of the modern way of looking at the past. And unfortunately, because of what Adolf Hitler did, Napoleon's great achievements have been sort of damaged, I think, in the light of subsequent events.
Yeah, I agree. I think David Chandler had a great quote on the comparison, and it was something like, it could be, nothing could be more flattering to Hitler than me to compare to Napoleon, and nothing could be more odious to Napoleon than be compared to Hitler, which I thought
so true. And also, I mean, look at Winston Churchill. You kindly mentioned that I was the biographer of Churchill. He called Napoleon the greatest man of action since Julius Caesar. And he absolutely hated Adolf Hitler and certainly wouldn't have said anything positive about Napoleon if he thought that Napoleon and Hitler had anything in common. In fact, one of the speeches he made during the Second World War explicitly rejected the idea that that Napoleon and Hitler had anything in common.
Regarding Napoleon's biography, obviously that's a long thing to get into, but what do you think is the most remarkable thing about his career? I'm kind of torn on this. People have different opinions. I just think that his accomplishments at such a young age were the most impressive, especially coming from almost minor nobility, almost nothing, to the relative backwater that is Corsica. Please forgive my Corsican listeners for me saying that. But what do you think is the most remarkable thing about his career?
Well, that's certainly one of them. Actually, I was in Corsica earlier this month on a trip to Corsica and Elba, and that's certainly one of them. I mean, to be a general by the age of 24, to have won the Battle of Lodi when at the age of 26, to be first consul by 30. I mean, these are incredible things. But greater than that, it strikes me, is the success that his great reforms had, the endless massive reforms, especially the ones between 1800 and 1805, when he essentially managed to keep the best bits of the French Revolution and discard all the mad and nutty and vicious ones.
Right.
That really, for me, that 1800 to 1805 period is the period of incredible success. And of course, actually, it's also a period of peace. Of course he was a conqueror, of course he was a soldier. You know, I visited 53 of his battlefields, so I'm under no illusions about that. but it's the things that he built, the things that lasted. Right. You know, once Waterloo was over, all those battles essentially are dead and buried. But the things that carry on, like the Code Napoleon that carries on in the Rhineland until 1900 and forms the basis of European law today, these things really are what he called the blocks of granite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Napoleonic Code, getting France in order after basically a decade of disorder, definitely, I think, are notable achievements, especially for a young man.
Yeah, and the education system, the Sorbonne, the Legion d'honneur, the Banque de France, the Cour des Comptes, you name it. It's just one amazing reforming thing after another. The architectural and infrastructural things that he built. The man was an absolute dynamo. of reform, administrative reform, economic reform, you name it. He was able to change his nation and subsequently Europe. And when his armies marched into places, you know, he would impose these reforms. And sometimes they went down well, sometimes they didn't, but they were impossible to ignore, and they really changed the way people lived.
Indeed. Well, let's touch on his wife, Josephine. And this is a kind of a broad question. Do you think she helped him or hindered him? I know she spent his money lavishly and she had several affairs, as did he, but we also must remember that his empire did go into decline after their divorce. And I think she taught him how to act in royal circles and how to deal with other dignitaries. What is your feeling on Josephine?
Very positive. I think she's a great woman. I think that I agree with everything you say, but I'd also add that she had a wonderful cultural influence on France, you know, quite beyond the sort of philanthropy and all the other things that royals did in those days. She had a wonderful taste for paintings and porcelain and furniture and the empire style and fashion and so on. You know, she really was able to give his reign that kind of cultural overview that that sets it apart really from a lot of other contemporary reigns and also other French reigns. So you know, she was, you only have to go to Malmaison, her beautiful home outside Paris, to appreciate that this was somebody who was redolent of style. And the empire style, I think, is something that has lasted long after her sad death in 1814 and, of course, his.
Yeah, indeed. That's a great answer. His family and members, same question could be asked. Did they help him or hinder him? Because clearly they weren't the best people, rather Machiavellian at times. Joseph, a failure as King of Spain. Jerome and Louis, not much better in their respective kingdoms. What do you think Napoleon should have done with these family members of his?
He once joked at a dinner, one of his many jokes, this is one of the reasons that he's nothing like Adolf Hitler. One of the many reasons is that he has a wonderful sense of humor. There are about 80 Napoleon jokes in my book. And one of the great gags he came out with was when he was having dinner with his family, and they were all arguing over which one should have which duchy and, you know, which hereditary bishopric and all that kind of business. And he shrugged, and at the height of the argument, he said, anyone would think that we were arguing over the bequest of our late father, the king. You know, he recognized, even though they didn't, that it was all down to him that any of them were anything more than, as you say, minor aristocracy. In fact, one of the things that is very noticeable in Corsica is that house in Ajaccio is it's a very nice house in the middle of the city. It's not the old city. It's not terribly far away from the cathedral where his great uncle was Archbishop Cardinal Fesch. But you know, it's not a genuine aristocratic house, especially as, of course, it's had an extra story built onto it since he was born there in 1769. So you have this family that, yes, it's got aristocratic escutcheon, or at least it got hold of it pretty quickly when Napoleon's father Carlo recognized that he could get free education for his children, military schools in France. But you know, they were not, Corsica doesn't have an aristocracy in that sense anyway. You know, nobody was a true aristocrat in Corsica, because that's not the nature of and the topography and the history of the island. Plus, of course, it wasn't French until the year before Napoleon was born.
Right.
And so this family didn't have any natural right to be, as you mentioned, king of Spain, king of Holland, king of Westphalia, and so on.
Right.
Let alone the sisters having their own duchies and the rest of it. So it's so they only really would be able to be helpful and useful if they were extremely good at running their own countries, which they were not. Not necessarily all the way down their fault. Louis actually essentially sympathized with the Dutch too much to be able to be a good satellite king, which was the whole point of him. Joseph was fighting against an insurgency that started from 1808 pretty much onwards, and so that was always going to be difficult. But Caroline and Murat in Naples turn against him. There's no support there. Lucien turns against him much earlier on than that and goes off to live in Rome. Is totally unhelpful to Napoleon. And although I'm sure she gave good sort of life advice, Madame Mère isn't really a major player. And so it's difficult, even at the Battle of Waterloo, where Jerome is in charge of trying to, or at least 50% in charge of trying to take Hougomont, even there he lets his brother down. So it's hard to point from the referendum, immediately after the Brumaire coup onwards, where Lucien is at least useful as interior minister, really where that family actually helps Napoleon. And so wouldn't it have been better, far better, to have instead appointed in each of these places? Sorry, can I just butt in myself? One thought there. Yep. Eugène wasn't bad as Viceroy of Italy, in fact.
True.
Eugène Beauharnais was not a bad Viceroy of Italy. So let's take Eugène and Hortense out of this, not least because they're not siblings, of course, of Napoleon's or blood relatives of Napoleon's. But with regard to the blood relatives, wouldn't it have been better instead to have appointed the most talented administrators in each of the places like Westphalia or Holland or Spain or whatever, and try to govern through them instead?
Yeah. Or just give them a small duchy or burg, like a small city to live in, or, you know, to give these people who have no experience being king or queen a kingdom was rather ridiculous. But
it was, but he wanted to be the Rudolf of his own dynasty, as he said. You know, he wanted to start the dynasty. You recognize that all dynasties start somewhere. With the Habsburgs, it started with Rudolf, and he wanted to be the Rudolf. But the thing is that it shouldn't have it should have been his offspring rather than his siblings. Given this thing, because I mean, it's a bit like lightning striking. That kind of genius hits Napoleon, but it doesn't, you know, it's not a bolt of lightning that also lightens up everything else around him.
Yeah, I've often said that, you know, just because I sit next to a genius and or take a class with a genius doesn't make me a genius, you know.
There's no osmosis in families for genius.
And we'll come back to that point here in just a minute. Regarding Napoleon's military acumen, which beyond comparison, why do you think he and his armies ran circles around the other armies in Europe for, gosh, a good decade?
Different reasons in different when fighting against different enemies. I think it was he was helped enormously by the Austrians' choice of generals. Especially in the Italian campaign, 1796 to 98 Italian campaign, he was able to run rings around these people because he was 26 and they were in their 70s.
Right.
You know, they were veterans of the Seven Years' War. And so that was going to give him a head start anyway. Then there was the revolutionary zeal, the whole idea that they were imparting to Europe a new set of values and principles that were going to really radically alter the whole way of life. And
you
get that very much through the concept of meritocracy. You know, when the French Revolution took place, up until that point, your place in the world, in society, was very much governed by who your father and grandfather had been. Whereas with Napoleon, you look at those 26 marshals, and half of them are the sons of barrel coopers and innkeepers and domestic staff and so on. You know, they're working class people who have shown through their merit, through their bravery on the battlefield, through their capacity to show leadership, that they can get to the top. And that, again, is something that that you know you didn't have in previous wars, was extremely useful. Mm-hmm. The actual kit that and equipment that Napoleon had to use wasn't that much different, actually, from what the French and Austrians and Prussians and Russians and British had been using, you know, for some time. Mm-hmm. The muskets and the cannon and so on. But right. The way in which it was organized, partly by Napoleon, partly by because of the books that he read on military structures, the introduction of the corps system was absolutely vital. And yes. Then, of course, he did have some absolute geniuses like Alexandre Berthier, his chief of staff, mm-hmm. who just knew how to do staff work in a way that was, frankly, much, much better than any of the other generals that they were up against. So there you are. There's five reasons. I could probably, if I scratch my head, come up with another five to explain what gave him that sort of special advantage. The drawback, of course, is that by 1812 or so, the other countries had been studying Napoleon for long enough to adopt their own corps system, for example, mm-hmm. you know, and actually learn from Napoleon.
Agreed.
Oh, sorry, can I add one other thing that's very important?
Please.
Apologies for butting in, but the other one, of course, is the levée en masse of the revolutionary period of the early 1790s, essentially gave armies to France that were far bigger than armies they'd had before, and also armies that they were likely to face. Now, that also is, that side of things is over by 1812. The other countries have instituted their own levée en masse by then, apart from Britain. And so that competitive advantage that they had was that sort of differential had gone by 1812.
Okay. Agreed with that one as well. Going back to my other point about generals and marshals, some of them had natural talent, some did not. I think Napoleon gets blamed unfairly for not teaching his marshals his style of warfare, but I've also pointed out that Beethoven or Mozart could give piano lessons to 1,000 students, but that doesn't mean any one of these 1,000 will turn into a legendary composer. Do you think too much of the French army's success is attributed to Napoleon? Like, are the marshals and generals just scapegoats when things go wrong? Or do you think some of these guys had talent as well?
Oh, I think a lot of them had very impressive talent. I really do. I mean, I'm sure the majority of your guests, for me, Marshal Davout,
of course,
is the great exemplar. Mm-hmm. I think he was up there with Napoleon's own capacity as a general and a commander. Mm-hmm. Marshal Ney, tough as old leather he was. You know, it's possible that he might have got PTSD by the end of being in charge of the rear guard in the retreat from Moscow. But up until then, he was fabulous. What they all had, Poniatowski, of course, as a cavalry commander, was really very special, as was Murat. You know, these guys, they, of course, had learnt their trade long before they ever met Napoleon. Mm-hmm. And even the middle-ranking marshals, Augereau springs to mind, were extremely useful soldiers. You know, there are a few get beaten in Spain, but that's largely because they're up against Wellington, who was himself, you know, a great captain of the era. If you're going to have a battle between Marmont, say, or even Massena and Wellington, Wellington's going to come off best, and did. But that doesn't really detract from the qualities of Marmont and Massena, in my view. So one of Napoleon's great capacities was this choice of his capacity to choose extremely good soldiers. I mean, they weren't always politically that trustworthy, Bernadotte, of course, being a country example. And another problem was that he didn't always have them in the right place at the at the right time. He did when they were shooting across Europe in 1805 to fight the Austerlitz campaign. But obviously, 10 years later, it would have done him much better to have left Soult back in Paris and to have had Davout on the battlefield of Waterloo and many other, and perhaps not given the battlefield commandership to Ney on the day of Waterloo. But, you know, by that stage, for political reasons and because of his 1814 abdication, he had far fewer marshals to work with.
Indeed, yeah. Well, I want to talk about the empire's high points and low points. Let's start with the high point. Do you think, and I'm going to give you a number of options to choose from.
I can tell you right now. Sorry, can I just butt in?
Please, go right ahead.
And just say Tilsit.
Tilsit, okay.
Tilsit's the apogee of the empire. It's the moment, you know, where it doesn't get better than this. He's essentially befriended Alexander the First. He's defeated everyone. He hasn't made the series of tragic errors that start in 1808 in the Iberian Peninsula. He's done all his, or at least instituted the vast majority of his reforms. His marriage is happy, or at least, you know, he's got loads of mistresses, but nonetheless. We're in a real state where the whole dynasty looks as though it's going to be rock solid, and it's a wonderful moment for him. Yes, the Battle of Trafalgar has meant that Britain is uninvadable, but but I think it pretty much was not going to be invaded once he had moved his armies across to fight the Austerlitz campaign anyway. So 1807, Tilsit. Sorry to butt in, but that's the great
sure. moment. Just for my audience, my other options were Austerlitz in 1805 or the birth of his son in 1811, because that, you know, somewhat solidified his, you know, heir to the empire and that kind of thing, which is why he divorced Josephine in the first place. So, yeah, I agree with you. Tilsit. We'll now move on to low points. And if you want to jump in and tell me which
No, give me a series. I feel a bit guilty about having jumped in last time. So give me your low points. My God, there are enough of them, aren't there?
So clearly his invasion of Portugal and Spain were a bad idea. Then he followed this up with a disastrous invasion of Russia in 1812. His major loss at Leipzig in 1813 was also devastating. His continental system was not well thought out. What do you think the low point was?
I think it was October 1812 at the Battle of Malo Yaroslavets, where he is stopped from pursuing the Russian army. He has to take the dogleg back via the battlefield of Borodino, and he and the winter is closing in. He's suddenly realizes that actually he needed more time to get from Moscow back to Smolensk than it took him getting from Smolensk to Moscow. And although he planned for that, after Malo Yaroslavets, it is pretty much downhill all the way. Yes, of course, you're right about Leipzig, but for me, these are, and of course, the 1814 campaign and the abdication and so on, 100 days. You know, you're replete with a whole series of low points. The meeting with Metternich, of course, also is a very low point. But they all start from the catastrophe in Russia, and the catastrophe in Russia doesn't start until Malo Yaroslavets.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah, I think. From that moment, it was all downhill. There was nothing he could do to save the empire because, you know, the winter showed up, the Russian army showed up, and he lost a large chunk of his army right there.
Huge. Yeah. I mean, over 500,000 men.
Yeah.
Which is impossible. And horses, of course, as well. You've got to remember the horses, because it's just as difficult, really, to replace them. So you have a situation after that where he just doesn't have the cavalry for big encircling movements. Now, that's not to say that he can't fight some extremely impressive battles. Look at the four victories in 5 days in the Champagne region in the March of 1814. But equally, that doesn't stop Marmont from surrendering Paris. You know, later on the following month.
Yeah. Yeah, in April 1814, he's exiled to Elba and lives there quite peacefully for a while. But against long odds, he famously returns and places himself back on the throne in 1815. Do you think if he won at Waterloo that he might have kept his crown, or do you think the Allies were determined to get rid of him once and for all?
I think from that decision they took on the, was it the 13th of March 1815, where they declared him an outlaw?
Mm.
Vienna made it perfectly clear that, yes, even if he had won and pushed Wellington back to the Channel ports and we had some kind of a Dunkirk 1940-style evacuation in 1815, right. He would still have had to have faced about 350,000 Russians that were on the march and 150,000 Austrians, you know. And one only has to look at that 1814 campaign to realise that, yes, he can win victories, but he can't win them forever. And once Paris has fallen once, it's not impossible that it'll fall again. So I think the chances of a Bonaparte dynasty ruling in France are pretty much dead from the declaration of him as an outlaw in the March of 1815 onwards.
Good answer. Well, he's exiled again in 1815 after Waterloo, this time to St. Helena, an island essentially in the middle of nowhere. What do you think his last years were like? I know clearly not happy, but what do you think those final few years were like?
I think they were necessary for his myth, the St. Helena years. He also, of course, burnished his myth by writing the best-selling book of the 19th century, Memorials of St. Helena, are absolutely essential for the burnishing of his sort of myth, the story of his epic. But my God, were they depressing for him? Of course, especially after in 1817 he's got cancer. But the early, even before that, I mean, the moment when he actually sees the cliffs, and I've been on a ship that came into the harbour in St. Helena from exactly the same direction. And you have these huge cliffs, sort of 400-500-foot cliffs. And he said, I wish I'd stayed in Egypt. And I can totally understand. When you go there, I can tell you, you can totally understand why, because it's an island about 8 miles by 10. There are 3,000 people who live on it now, 2,000 of which have left the island, but there are 1,000 people who have never left the island. So, you know, from being master of Europe, you're then interned on this tiny little island, which, as you say, is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it would have saved a lot of trouble and indeed 100,000 lives if he'd been put on St. Helena rather than Elba in 1814. Right. But that wasn't the deal. You know, there was a straightforward deal done with the Allies, and that wasn't the deal. Equally, if he'd fallen into the hands of the Prussians, there's no saying whether they wouldn't have just hanged him
right
in 1815. So you know, you need the St. Helena option, really, if you're going to retain a kind of civilized way of dealing with him, unless you think he's Hitler and a war criminal, in which case, obviously, he deserved to be hanged. But when you go to St. Helena, you very quickly... I don't want to be rude to anyone in St. Helena who might be listening to this, but you very quickly do recognise why it was destructive of Napoleon's soul to have to spend 5.5 years there.
Yeah, and he probably, I would imagine, reflected on his mistakes or where he went wrong, whether it was Marmont or Bernadotte or invading Russia or, you know, to have 6 years to sit and reflect on how you had everything and now you have nothing, that must have been very destructive to his soul as well.
Well, yes, and you see that, of course, from the memorials of St. Helena. But he doesn't. He doesn't blame himself at any stage. You know, there isn't. Yes, of course, he had long moments in which to think about where it all went wrong. But what he didn't use those moments in order to go, oh, damn, I wish I hadn't invaded the Iberian Peninsula and right. Russia at all. You know, there isn't that level of self-criticism. There's a good deal of self-pity in that, but there's very little in terms of an actual recognition of having made mistakes. There's a lot about how unlucky Waterloo was, for example. Mm-hmm. Very little. I mean, there's not a word about the fact that Wellington was an extremely good soldier, and they were very well dug in, and they had chosen their position very well, and the Anglo-Allied army performed excellently, and his cavalry charges didn't, and you know, none of the squares broke, and all of this kind of thing. There, if he had had a deep, maybe he did personally understand that it was partly his fault, but it wasn't going to fit into the Napoleonic myth to admit as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, he passes there, I believe, in 1821. What do you think his legacy is, though? That's a tough question.
It is, yeah, because it, and not least is it being battled over constantly. You know, in France today, the left want to see somebody who justified war crimes in Haiti, which he did do, mm-hmm. And who kept women subjugated by the Code Napoleon, which he also did do. The right look at some of those things that we were mentioning earlier, the Banque de France, the Légion d'honneur, the ways of ruling France, the administration, saving France from the massive inflation, imposing law and order when there was virtual, you know, civil war in the countryside, ending the reign of terror so that 40,000 people who'd been guillotined, you know, that stopped under him. So did mob rule stop under him. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a literature, an art, a culture that was vibrant under him. There are just so many examples. When you go on your romantic weekend to Paris, you're going to cross over one of the four bridges that he built. You know, the mm-hmm. reservoirs there, the sheer ability to sort of grip a nation that was in massive crisis, and the Directory was profoundly corrupt mm-hmm. and incompetent. And instead, you create a legacy that has lasted and will last, I think, long beyond the carpers and the critics and the people who quite wrongly see him as having anything in common with Adolf Hitler. You know, when his troops went into cities, mm-hmm. They opened up the ghettos, and they freed the Jews, and they gave them social and economic rights. Precisely mm-hmm. the opposite, of course, of what the Nazis were doing when they went into the ghettos.
Right, right. Yeah, it's. He is a contrast and compare and conflicting character. Like, it's, yeah, he did some good things. Yeah, he did some bad things. But on the whole, I think he made France better than it was when he got there.
That's right. And also, it's very important, you know, this thing that he's a warmonger. Well, we've already mentioned the Iberian Peninsula and the 1812 campaign, and he was responsible for both of those. But those were two campaigns out of the seven wars of the coalition mm-hmm. that were fought between the outbreak of the French Revolution and 1815. And, you know, the Allies were responsible for the other five. What's he expected to do in 1805 when Austria invades Bavaria, France's ally? Of right. course he has to go to war. He has right. to go to war in 1800 over Austrian implications in Italy. The Allies pick the fight with him in 1813 and again in 1814, and then they declare him an outlaw in 1815 after he has been he returns in triumph and mm-hmm. sits down and eats Louis the 18th's dinner at the Tuileries. You know, I mean, yeah. Out of the seven wars of coalition, he's responsible for two. The Allies, who understandably want to destroy this fresh wind of meritocracy, especially the Ancien Régime style countries of Prussia, Austria, and Russia. And so let's get all of this into proportion about this so-called warmonger. when he invaded Russia in 1812, he had an army twice the size of the Russian army, but he only wanted to go about 50 miles into Russia. He only wanted to have a sort of 3-week campaign. The idea that he was actually ever going to wind up in Moscow was, he'd have considered that ludicrous in June 1812. But it was a brilliant strategy of the Russians to essentially lure him in to destroy half their country, half the European part of their country. High risk, but it worked, of course, ultimately. But you see, it doesn't mean that Napoleon had some kind of a Napoleon complex. There is such a thing as a Napoleon complex. It's just that Napoleon didn't have it. Hmm. He'd beaten the Russians twice before, and he reckoned he could again. So the idea that he'd suddenly gone mad in 1812, I think, is ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. That was fantastic. I learned so much in our chat there, and I think that's why there's so many books written about this man. He's just fascinating. And I hope you write some more for us on Napoleon, if you have time.
Just before I go, can I tell you another Napoleon gag?
Please.
Remembered? This is one of my favorite Napoleon jokes, which is when the Cardinal Archbishop of Rheims writes to him an incredibly sucky, uppy, oleaginous letter about the coronation, saying how wonderful Napoleon is about everything and so on. Napoleon writes on the top right-hand corner of the letter, which is where he gave sort of notes on what to do with incoming correspondence. He said, "Please, can you pay? Can't remember. Was it 3,000 francs to the Cardinal Archbishop out of the theatrical fund?"
a bit too theatrical in his life.
Exactly. He was being over theatrical.
Yeah, there's times where he can be funny, even on the battlefield. You know, he told Murat to take off some of his flamboyant uniforms and put his regular officer's uniform on. I know when Marshal Bessier was injured, he was joked that he was the only man that could make his guard cry.
And Juno as well at Acre, where the cannonball comes and flicks sand into everyone's faces. He makes a joke about that as well. Can you imagine having the coolness, the sheer sort of savoir-faire to be able to make jokes during a battle?
Yeah, no, that's impressive. Again, if you'd like to learn more about Andrew Roberts, please check out his books. I recommend starting with Napoleon: A Life, but he has a fine list of books to choose from. And Andrew, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm actually going to Waterloo tomorrow morning. I take visitors around the battlefield occasionally. So when I get to the top of the Lion Mound, I will think of you.
Please do. And we appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks very much.